This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. One of the themes in mainstream psychology in the United States today is that when you really get down to it, most human beings pretty much think the same way. In other words, no matter the color of our skin or where we're raised, we all use the same processes of thought to understand the world. Our senses perceive the same things, which we then categorize according to universal rules of logic. For much of his professional life, Richard Nisbet agreed. A few years back, though, he began to question the universality of human thought. Nisbet is a professor of psychology at the University of Michigan and co-director of the Culture and Cognition Program there. He and his co-workers have been doing experiments on how people think, trying to get a better understanding of the role of culture. He has a new book out. It's titled The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently. Richard Nisbet joins us now from member station WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Let's begin with a bit of an overview, if you will. Can you give us the broad strokes? I mean, how do Asians and Westerners think differently?
Well, let me start by saying how I got into the business of looking at the difference. I had a very brilliant Chinese student a number of years back named Kaiping Peng, who told me one day that he and I were different. I thought the world was a line, and he thought the world was a circle. I did a bit of a double take on that, and he began to tell me what has turned out to be the story of our research, essentially. He said that Westerners are analytic. They tend to think about an object. They zero in their perception on a particular object. It could be a person. Think about its attributes and try to categorize the object on the basis of its attributes and to think of the rules that apply to the behavior of the object with a view toward controlling it. And among the rules that people use, Westerners use, to think about things are the formal rules of logic. In contrast, East Asians have a holistic way of thinking. They pay attention to a much broader field than Westerners do. They pay attention to the situation that a person is in. They pay attention to the context that a physical object is in. And they're much more concerned with relationships among objects and relationships among people than Westerners are. And they don't have such explicit rules for the behavior of objects and people. And they don't expect to have such control over them as Westerners do. Mm. And among the rules they don't have are the rules of logic. At least they use the rules of logic to think about everyday life events less than Westerners do.
Well, the metaphor of you know, Westerners think in a line, Asians think in a circle, it's a good metaphor, but you're a scientist. I mean, how do you go about, what kind of experiments can you do to prove that sort of thing?
Well, to give you an example of one of our favorites, we show people movies of underwater scenes, and there's always a particularly salient object, usually a fish, and we define salience by the fact that one of these fish is larger, brighter, and faster moving than the others. And we show these scenes for 20 seconds, and then we ask people what it is they have seen. And Westerners, the first thing they say is, well, and then they zero in on the central object. They say, I saw what looked like a trout swimming off to the left. It maybe had some pink speckles on its belly. East Asians are much more likely to start out by saying, I saw what looked like a stream. There were rocks on the bottom and some plants. So they start out with the context. Altogether, our Japanese subjects, in one experiment that we ran, remembered 60% more detail about the environment or the background than the American subjects that we tested did. And they actually saw 100% more, twice as many, relationships involving inanimate objects as the Americans did. It's as if it wasn't moving, it wasn't really there for the Americans.
Hmm. We'd like to hear from listeners on all of this. Do your experiences, listeners, suggest that people from different cultures think differently? If so, how? And if not, why not? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest, of course, is Richard Nisbett, professor of psychology and co-director of the Culture and Cognition Program at the University of Michigan. We're talking about his new book, The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently and Why. And, Professor, you didn't do just the lab experiments like the one you were just describing. You also looked at literature, and you trace a lot of this back to really the philosophies that tend to define Western and East Asian culture to ancient Greeks and ancient Chinese.
That's right. There's been this sort of parallel path that Western intellectual history has been following. The British empirical philosophers, Hume, Locke, and Mill, it never occurred to them, really, that people might think differently. Everyone had the same means of perceiving the world and remembering things and making inferences and judgments about the world. And that was only enhanced by the tradition of 20th century psychology. Freud and Piaget never really doubted that people had fundamentally different rules for cognitive operations. And modern cognitive science has taken it even a step further, partly, I think, because of the metaphor of the computer. All computers have very similar hardware and operating principles. And you can change the software a bit, maybe the things that people think about or the particular kinds of causal theories that they have. But at bedrock, all machines are the same, all people are the same.
Well, you could go to the metaphor of anatomy, and all people have pretty much the same hardware.
That's right. I mean, certainly everyone thinks we're born with the same hardware. The question is, how deep do the changes go? And what we've found is that the changes go much deeper. The other intellectual tradition that's been going on just in parallel, and I think we may be among the first people to realize it, is a very large number of anthropologists and historians and philosophers of science have been saying for quite a while that there are dramatic differences between the way people of East Asian culture and European culture reason and perceive the world. And their main evidence for that is ancient Greek science and philosophy as compared to ancient Chinese science and philosophy. And they are really remarkably different along the lines that I discussed initially when I was characterizing the differences among modern Asians and Westerners. For example, in Aristotle, you have no recognition that objects behave the way they do because of their context or their environments. So that for Aristotle, a stone falls when it drops into water, falls to the bottom because the stone has the property of gravity. Of course, a piece of wood that's dropped in water floats on top of the water. And why is that? Well, Aristotle had to invent a new property there, so he called it the property of levity that a piece of wood has. No real recognition that the surrounding substance there played a role, or that there could be any unseen forces that might be important in producing that behavior. In contrast, among ancient Chinese, the concept of action at a distance was understood from a very early point. The Chinese understood, for example, the real reason for the tides, which of course is the tug of the moon.
Yep.
And this was not understood even by Galileo. It was that knowledge had to come to the West after Galileo. The Chinese also understood a lot about properties of audition, and of magnetism. All of these things were mysteries, really, essentially until the 18th century or even later for the West. And because of this habit of mind of thinking about context on the part of the Chinese versus zeroing in on the object on the part of the Greeks.
Our telephone number again is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And our first caller is Hannah, who's with us from Franklinville, New Jersey.
Hi. I agree wholeheartedly about the difference in the West and the East, but I think it is something that's taught in school at a very early age, and a child who may see things more, as you're saying, who would look out on a scene and maybe see many different things or things interacting with one another, may be corrected by a teacher that they're not able to focus, they're not paying attention, they don't understand the situation, or you may be told to rearrange a story into certain sentences to create a paragraph, and you'll be corrected if you don't put those in the proper order. So I think the mind is very malleable, and that actually a lot of damage is done in the West by saying that there's only one right way to think, or as an artist, only one right way to see or paint. And a lot of schooling goes into that, but I think a lot of emotional damage is done in the process.
Professor Nisbet?
I agree with much of what you say. Actually, though, I believe that the differences start even before school. I think they start really practically in the crib. There's a wonderful study that's been done by a couple of different sets of investigators. Very simple study where they just put mothers in a room with their toddler infants and ask them to play with a set of objects, a truck, a soft toy, etc., just as they normally would. The American mothers tend to show the kid the object. They'll say, look, Billy, it's a truck. See, it's got nice wheels. In effect, look, Billy, object. Note category. Check out attributes. Whereas the Japanese mother is more likely to say, it's a vroom vroom. I give it to you. You give it to me. Yes, thank you. In other words, much more emphasis on the interpersonal relationship and on the emotional aspect of interaction. The mother, in fact, the Japanese mother, is likely to focus the child's face, even taking the child's face in her hands and focusing it on her own face so that they can share the reaction to this object.
And have you found that there is any emotional repercussions to the Western view where children are maybe categorized as hyperactive or unable to focus because they're less malleable to this kind of a directive than other children?
There's no question that Westerners do categorize people and think of their attributes as being more inflexible. And I do think that that does damage. If a child is not performing well in arithmetic in school, we just say, well, the kid doesn't have much ability in arithmetic. That's not the East Asian way at all. You'd say, well, the child's not trying hard enough, or the teacher hasn't found a way to reach the child. And there's an assumption of malleability on the part of East Asians for both abilities and for personality and for moral characteristics.
Would you just say that on the Eastern side there are any square pegs who maybe do look at things more linearly or focus in on an object, and so they wind up being out of place in their culture, or it's overall more accepting?
I think that's a fascinating question. We don't really know the answer to that question. We certainly do get variation in the way people behave in our experiments. We don't ever, of course, and maybe I should have started early by saying this, we don't find ever that all of the Asians behave in one way and all of the Westerners behave in another way. There's always a distribution. So when I make these pronouncements about the way people behave differently, I'm always talking about on average, though in fact, a lot of our differences are quite large. Really enough to make a huge difference in thinking in everyday life.
Hannah, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're talking about the geography of thought with author Richard Nisbet, and we're taking your calls at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Or you can send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. We'll be back after a short break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A little bit later in the program, we're going to take a look at interrogation and what the government hopes to learn from this weekend's arrest of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, supposedly the operations director of Al-Qaeda. Right now, we continue our discussion about culture and thought and how thinking styles may differ between East and West. Our guest is Richard Nisbet, author of The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently. Of course, you're invited to join the discussion. Did you have the experience of changing how you think when the culture you lived in changed? Give us a call. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email TOTN@NPR.org. And we got an email from Emma Cornell, PhD, just before the break. We were talking about education. As an English professor, she writes, I was surprised when one of my students, who had been a teacher in China before coming here, told me that she didn't understand the requirements of essay structure. I told her to write a thesis statement and then prove its 3 points in the following paragraphs. She told me if she wrote this way in China, she would be considered stupid. In China, she said, essays were written in a more circular fashion, moving associated ideas closer and closer to the center. I don't know how to write this way myself, but I was impressed by her description. Does that go along with your thesis?
Absolutely. It's a perfect example of what we're talking about. In the West, we have a notion of what an essay or a case, a court case, or a policy statement should look like, and it's all pretty much the same kind of outline. You start out with a general statement of the problem, you give a specific hypothesis or suggested solution, you present the evidence in favor of your position, you argue against the reasons that somebody might not believe your position, you summarize and you give a conclusion. This is absolute second nature to us, and it starts really in nursery school with kids doing show and tell. This is my teddy, and I like him because, and we build from there all the way through education. This structure of rhetoric is simply not understood in the East. They don't do it that way, and it's quite true that they not only don't do it that way, they think it's a way that somebody who wasn't too bright would have to have things done to them. They think it's more literary, more interesting, and ultimately a deeper way to present things, to cycle back into the same topic from various directions.
Our next caller is Scott, who's on the line with us from Indianapolis.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call today.
Mm-hmm.
Richard, how are you doing today?
Okie doke.
Good. I am wondering, I do a lot of personality work based on Jungian models in my consulting work, and when I'm working in large multinational companies, this kind of question comes up all the time. And what I'm wondering if you've ever studied or considered going in this direction is the difference to which the long-standing patterns of behavior might actually ultimately affect the way people evolve biochemically, and how much that might impact their personalities or the way this all works.
In other words, are you asking, is this genetic or is this cultural?
Well, and what's the combination? Because there's a bit of a chicken-egg argument that goes on.
Okay.
I think there's no part of it is genetic. I think it's all environmental. Our main reason for believing that is that in some of the studies that we do, we look at Asian Americans, and they're always between East Asians and European Americans. Sometimes they're almost identical to European Americans. So really, we know it's not genetic. On the other hand, if you're asking is there biological or biochemical consequences of this, there's no question that there are. I mean, this stuff is changing the structure of the brain. I mean, we know that any form of learning does that. So a question for the future, and unfortunately it's not one that I'm going to be able to ask in my own research because it's way outside my competence, is what does this do to the psychobiology of the brain, to the neuroscience of the underlying mental structure?
Right. Okay, well, thank you very much for answering that for me.
Okay, Scott, okay, thanks for the call.
Uh-huh. Bye-bye.
And I wanted to ask you, though, about some of the other differences as you describe it in the book. You delve into the realm of mathematics for a while and note that the ancient Chinese excelled at algebra and arithmetic, but not at geometry, which, of course, was the province of the brilliant Greek Euclid. Why the difference?
Well, we think the difference was because geometry, or a lot of it at any rate, requires deduction. And deduction just was not a strength of the Chinese. The whole formal logical tradition that is so much a part of the Western intellectual tradition is simply absent in China.
Mm-hmm.
You have a little bit of concern with logic about the 3rd century B.C., but it died away, and there's been almost no concern with it since. In contrast, of course, the Greeks invented the syllogism and all kinds of formal operations, that's been the Greek tradition that stayed with us ever since. So I think the main reason for the Greek success in geometry was because of their success in logic.
So the straight line does have its advantages. If it lacks nuance, it at least gets you someplace.
That's right.
Here's an email question from Mary Vogt, and this she's writing from Cambridge. Go, she says, is an ancient strategy board game highly regarded in several East Asian societies. The rules and pieces are simpler than chess, but playing the game becomes much more complex. It could be said to reflect the holistic nature of East Asian thought. If Dr. Nismit is familiar with the game of Go, I'd be very interested to hear his opinions.
I'm not really familiar with it, but your opinion is certainly shared. There's actually a PhD dissertation on that very topic, saying that essentially chess is linear. I mean, you think of the rules that each piece must follow, different rules for different pieces, in contrast to the much looser structure and more holistic structure of Go. So you're certainly in good company when you have that belief.
Our next caller is Darshi, who's calling from Los Angeles.
Hi. I just have a comment, actually. It was really interesting to me to hear what you were talking about, the way of thinking and the East being circular and linear in the West, because I've always told my husband, who's actually American, Scandinavian descent, and I'm South Asian, I'm from Sri Lanka, I always thought that he thought circular. He always, like, whenever we ever even had arguments, it's always because he doesn't get to the point as I want him to, and he goes around and around with it. And he is extremely good at qualitative research because of that, I think. And I'm so much more linear, and it was just interesting to me to hear that this is how you thought that East Asians would think.
Well, like I admitted before, there are individual differences
in
different cultures.
I just thought of that as being like the thing that I've always talked about, and it was just interesting to hear it over the radio.
Well, thanks very much for the comment, Darshi. Appreciate it. But that does raise the question, Professor, have you looked at other cultures and how they think? I mean, for example, has there been comparable studies with African cultures or with Australian Aborigines or people like that?
Well, let me back up just a bit from that and say why we think these cognitive differences exist. We think that they exist because Asians and Westerners live in very different worlds. Asians live in very complicated social worlds. They have more social obligations. They have a wider range of roles that they have to play with different people. And individualist Westerners live in simpler worlds where they can zero in on some particular goal that they have, some particular thing that they want to achieve without paying that much attention to other people. And we think that that plays a large role in these cognitive differences. Now, that said, really it's Westerners and the rest of the world on the other side, in effect, because Westerners are much more individualistic than other people in general. It's particularly true of East Asians, but it's also true of Africans. It's even true within the European culture that Americans are more individualist, certainly, than Mediterranean Europeans. Even Northwestern Europeans, the English, the Dutch, and so on, are more individualist than Latins. So there's kind of a continuum here, and there's some reason to think that East Asians are on one end of the continuum, but everybody in the world really is less individualist and probably therefore shifted in this more circular reasoning direction than Westerners are.
When you are making generalizations about cultural differences in cultural psychology and challenging the perception that, gee, we more or less think the same, Are you ever accused of being a racist?
Well, I've only talked about this in front of basically in front of scientists, and when they hear our case, they see why we think the way we do. We don't get accused of that. But then, of course, since we don't think that the differences are genetic and have good evidence that that's not the case, it would be unusual to call us racist.
Mm-hmm.
But another way of answering the question is it a safe thing or an unsafe thing to believe that profound differences exist between peoples in the way, in something so fundamental as the way they think? And I have three answers to that. The first answer is the differences are there. And given that they're there, as a scientist, I think that normally the assumption ought to be that you're better off knowing if some difference is there than if you don't know the difference is there. A second reason is that it really helps to reduce conflict, I think. There are plenty of occasions of conflict, and they're going to keep on increasing as the world gets smaller and smaller between East Asians and Westerners in terms of their different approach to different subjects. And we're well armed for that, for those kinds of conflicts, and helping to diffuse them if we know the true nature of the differences. We don't attribute it to the other person just being a jerk, but to the other person literally having a fundamentally different way of viewing the world. And the third reason is that I think there's a lot wrong with the way Westerners think. I also think there's things wrong with the way Easterners think. And we can hold a mirror up to each other and learn how to correct our own errors. Certainly, I found that in my own case, that I've come to think in a more Eastern fashion, or picked up some of the Eastern cognitive virtues. Honestly, I'm not sure that I have done that to a great extent, but I certainly have come to believe that there are different ways of thinking that I would be well advised to adopt if I were capable of it.
The ideas of Darwin were used by some to justify social Darwinism, which many would theorize led to even to Nazism. Are you afraid that your work might be misinterpreted and used by racists to justify their not only thinking, well, they think differently and worse than we do?
I can't imagine anybody who knows the full range of our work thinking that it makes any sense to say that one group thinks worse than the other. There are clear advantages to thinking like an Easterner in some respects. I mean, look, just to take the first experiment that I described, being able to see a much wider range of the environment, surely that's something that everyone would want to have, whether Western or Eastern. Whether it's something that a Westerner can pick up by learning what it is that Easterners do, we don't really know, although there are some reasons to think that that you can eliminate perceptual bottlenecks of various kinds. So it might be something that's teachable.
Go ahead. Go finish your thought.
And we certainly know that logic is teachable to Easterners. In fact, in our studies where we look at the use of logic on the part of Easterners versus Westerners, Westerners use logic more when thinking about everyday life events. But if you ask people to think about purely abstract propositions using logic, Easterners are as capable of doing it as Westerners. It's just that it's not a habit that's so ingrained in their approach to the world.
We're speaking with Professor Richard Nisbet about his new book, The Geography of Thought, How Asians and Westerners Think Differently and Why. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Our next caller is Owen, who's on the line with us from Jackson, Michigan.
Good afternoon.
Afternoon.
I'm interested in if you've considered the effects of tonal language on the result. It seems to me that since we're talking about how people think with words, the East Asians generally use tonal languages, and could I have your thoughts on it?
Well, first of all, probably the single most important thing that's been discovered, and it's not really by us along these lines, is that there's good evidence that Westerners are more likely to think verbally, and Easterners are more likely to think non-verbally or geometrically or visually. And this was discovered by a very clever Korean graduate student at Stanford, who said to her advisor one day, "You know, I'm getting tired of these Western professors always telling me that I've got to speak up in class, that if I don't do that, it shows a lack of understanding of the material, and that I would understand better if I pitched in and made comments and asked questions." And she said, "I'm sorry, that's just not the way I think. I don't think in that kind of verbal, linear way. I think in a much broader way, and talking actually interferes with my process of thinking." And then she proceeded to prove it by asking people to solve anagrams, either while they were talking about what their solutions were, talking out loud, or remaining silent. It made absolutely no difference to her American subjects whether they were talking or not, but it impaired the performance of her Asian subjects and of her Asian American subjects to have to speak while they were thinking. And she argues along the lines that we do, that if you think in a relatively linear way and you're paying attention to central objects and you paying attention to a fewer total number of things when you're thinking, words are pretty well adapted to that. They're adequate to that task. But if you're thinking about a much wider range of events and objects, words are just going to get you confused because you're thinking much more broadly. And you can get into trouble if you're trying to say everything in words.
Owen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And we just have about a minute and a half left, Professor. And I was wondering if you thought there was a possibility. You talked about the advantages and disadvantages of both ways of thinking. Synthesis. Is there some way we can use both ways of thinking and help ourselves along?
Well, that's one of the great questions that's left now is how much of the tricks of one side can you give to the other side? I think we've already got some evidence that Easterners are quite good, thank you, at learning some of the Western tricks. As I say, logic, certainly all forms of mathematics, where of course there's a strong Eastern tradition anyway. But East Asians do extremely well in mathematics and in science, though not in the most creative forms of science. That remains a Western advantage. And there are a lot of reasons that you can point to, I think, in our work to imply why that might be. First of all, the habit just of thinking logically about ordinary events has an advantage for science, possibly especially for novel forms of science. So I think there's no question that that they can learn from us. Can we learn from them? Well, I don't know. Can we learn perceptually? I hope so. I hope that I'm able to pay a wider attention to the world now than I did before I began this work.
Richard Nisbett's new book is The Geography of Thought. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Professor Nisbett was with us from the studios of WUOM in Michigan.